Here's a quote from Allen Ginsberg, who was highly influential among the young generation in America in the 1960s. Well, especially among the hippies, and prior to that, the beatniks. He was a dissolute poet, and the following, although it's in prose, it sounds quite poetic. He stated, Swami Bhaktivedanta came to the USA and went swiftly to the archetype spiritual neighborhood, the New York Lower East Side, and installed intact an ancient, perfectly preserved piece of street India. He adorned a storefront as his ashram and adored Krishna therein, and by patience and good humor, singing, chanting, and expounding Sanskrit terminology day by day, established Krishna consciousness in the psychedelic mind-manifesting center of America East. To choose to attend to the Lower East Side, what kindness and humility and intelligence. So we might not agree with everything there, for instance, calling the New York Lower East Side the archetype, I guess it should be the archetypal spiritual neighborhood, but there's some good insights there, no doubt. Srila Prabhupada certainly made an impression on his early followers and his later followers also. It wasn't just because people who came to Prabhupada, they liked the prasadam, they liked the chanting, they were intrigued by the philosophy. These were all factors in their taking to Krishna consciousness. But among the early followers especially, perhaps the major factor was Srila Prabhupada himself and his personal association. Later on, some of Srila Prabhupada's disciples, they became the major factor in people taking to Krishna consciousness and staying in Krishna consciousness. Vishnu Jan was famous for attracting people to Krishna consciousness. Tamal Krishna Maharaj brought many people to Krishna consciousness, trained them in Krishna consciousness, and in the very early days, the very beginning of the movement, Srila Prabhupada's personality, who he was, meant so much to his disciples that many of them expressed that they took great pleasure in serving him, although as hippies, Americans, they don't take pleasure in serving others. It's just not part of the culture. New people coming, anyone, whether they joined him or not, if they had contact with him, they were impressed that he was content to live on the Bowery. Okay, Jai, Hare Krishna. Which at the time seems to have been the worst part of New York City. Which is saying something, because New York City is, many parts of it are not very good at all. Worst, well, maybe Harlem also. But at least for a non-black area, Bowery seems to be in the worst. That Srila Prabhupada is quite content to live this. In this way, Srila Prabhupada lived or exemplified the teachings of Krishna Bhagavad Gita. Again and again, these particular teachings I'm referring to is that self-realized soul is equipoised in any condition. He's not attached to any fancy apartment, or he's not repulsed by any horrible situation. Of course, later, Srila Prabhupada, he did have many fancy apartments. Maybe many of you have seen Srila Prabhupada's apartment at Bhaktivedanta Mana. It's first class, as in Melbourne, really first class apartment. In Los Angeles, it's actually quite small, but it's certainly a lot better than the Bowery in 1966. But then again, we see that Srila Prabhupada in early 1977, when he had so many fancy apartments all over the world, was content to live for several weeks in a field, actually, that was the site of what is now the temple of Krishna Balaram at Bhuvaneshwar. But at the time, it was just a field, and there were two or three little cottages, and Srila Prabhupada is quite content to live there and take baths with the tube well. So it wasn't that Srila Prabhupada is attached to these facilities. Shouldn't be considered like that. But he understood the utility of them for preaching, and actually at Bhaktivedanta Mana, so many important people of British society came to visit Prabhupada. If they'd been asked to visit him in the slum areas of Stratford in London at the time, that was Deptford, they were all slum areas at the time, these people wouldn't have come. But if they're invited to a fancy country house, then they'll think it's suitable for them. We see in Melbourne also there are so many, there are several video recordings of Srila Prabhupada talking to respectable members of society, lawyers and social workers and all this kind of thing. But in the beginning, Srila Prabhupada he accepted what was available at the time, provided by Krishna, as he would say, and dressed in very simple clothes. And despite being an elderly gentleman, he was prepared to mix with the hippies, which no one except a hippie in America was prepared to mix with the hippies, and they didn't particularly want to mix with anyone else either. He gave his time to them. He was obviously from a very aristocratic background by his whole deportment, by his deep learning. He's obviously a very, very special person. Even without understanding, we can't really understand how special Srila Prabhupada is. We say Krishna Prishta every day. We say his pranam mantra, that he's very dear to Krishna. What that means to be dear to Krishna, especially in our present state of maintaining attachment to things in this material world, we can hardly begin to imagine what it means to be dear to Krishna. But even if we could, still we couldn't fathom how special Srila Prabhupada is, how dear to Krishna he is. That they say about Jesus, that God sent his only begotten son to whatever that means. How did he beget him when there's a Virgin Mary? I wonder if they ever thought about that. But that's the idea. He's very, very special. And of course, Srila Prabhupada, we can understand, is much more special than Jesus, although Christians wouldn't like to hear that. But actually, any one of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's followers is more important. As Srila Prabhupada, echoing Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, explains in a Chaitanya Charitamrita purport in relationship to Vasudev Datta's being prepared to take on all the sins of all the living beings of the universe so they can all be liberated. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur points out in this connection that Jesus was prepared to take the sinful reactions of his followers, but Vasudeva Datta was prepared to take the sinful reactions of everyone. So Srila Prabhupada was deputed to give much more complete knowledge of God than Jesus did. Anyway, let's not get into too much of a tangent about Jesus. Hayagriva describes in his book, The Hare Krishna Explosion, speaking about Srila Prabhupada, his attire is humble, ascetic, a saffron dhoti worn in the style of a sannyasi monk, and a saffron chada over his shoulders. As he sits erect and cross-legged, this would be at the early morning classes, his body seems to dwindle, his magnetism and personality, I don't know what's that, dwindle, don't seem to be the right word. His magnetism and personality are concentrated in his face, large and noble like a Buddha's. It is a serene, meditative, grave face, a tranquil face, encompassing joy, compassion, sorrow, and much, much more. It is a face unlike I have ever seen, any other that I've ever seen. Hayagriva also described about the early morning classes in New York City, the Matchless Gift storefront. With just a handful of people coming, no one committed. Entranced, we listen to Swamiji chant. His presence dominates the small room. Absorbed in chanting, he closes his eyes. His head is golden, shiny, radiant. As he chants, he looks like a happy child calling to his maker. Hayagriva wrote that his head is golden, shiny, radiant. We can surmise that his heart is also golden, shiny, radiant. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. So, Srila Prabhupada's early followers were, to greater or lesser extent, rebelling against American values. It was a great shock for their parents, who had been through the Second World War, won the Second World War for the sake of civilization, which is epitomized as modern America, where everyone in America, they can live to the full extent of civilization, have a good income and a house and their own car. And it was the American dream come true, but the American dream started to turn into a nightmare for those who were living it when their sons and their daughters, Bob Dylan song, what is that? Your sons and your daughters are beyond your control because the times they are a change. I don't remember the whole line. They, especially from the middle class, that means white, so many young people, they felt this was unfulfilling, unsatisfying, that just growing up, getting a job, earning money, getting married, driving a car around, there's got to be more to life than this. They found it spiritually empty, even though Christianity was even more pervasive in American life at that time than it is now. And it's still a major influence in American life. So the hippie movement, not an organized movement, but a spontaneous movement, undefined, but clearly an observable phenomenon. This arose largely due to discontent with the American way of life as it was at that time, and it looked to mysticism, especially Eastern mysticism, because actually mysticism is much more prominent historically in the Eastern world than it is in the West. It's never been much encouraged. Although there have been Western mystics, it was never much encouraged by the Christian religion. And in Islam, there were and are quite a few mystics, especially the Sufis, but they were not and are not much appreciated by, especially by Sunni Muslims who consider themselves to be the most orthodox. Well, the Shias do too also. But in the Eastern world, mysticism, by which I mean the search for the highest truth, often the search within, often involves leaving society, not necessarily. William Blake in England didn't leave society, although he was a mystic and having visions of God, becoming absorbed in God. This kind of thing could get you burned at the stake or tortured on the rack in Christian society before the rise of humanistic values. one major reason why Christianity is not burning people at the stake nowadays is due to more or less atheistic humanism. Anyway, that's another topic. So the hippies, theirs was a rebellion, not an armed rebellion, but a behavioral rebellion. So conscious alteration, that was what they were interested in, accessing higher or at least altered states of consciousness, which, if you think about it, that's at the heart of what goes by the name of mysticism. So how did they do that? Well, drugs was a major factor in that. Music and to some extent sex, although that was mostly for, well, it was cast as being spiritual, but it wasn't so much part of the mystic quest of the hippies. It was just it was gross sense gratification, and at the same time it was the idea of free sex was a rebellion against, at that time, standard American values, by which one should be married to or one should indulge in sexual activity within marriage. That's changed now. The hippies became, a lot of the hippie values became mainstream. So Srila Prabhupada was preaching among these people. Why did Srila Prabhupada preach in these people? Among these people? Why them? Why among all the people in America did Srila Prabhupada preach among them? The answer is that Srila Prabhupada, he didn't first and foremost aim at them, or chronologically he didn't aim to preach among the hippies, but circumstantially it happened that he had to, well, he came from his first place of residence, or not exactly residence, his, well, for a short time he was residing there. In Butler, Pennsylvania, he came to New York City, which is obviously a much more important place if you want to start a movement and get things going. Then a big city is better than a small town. So he came to New York City, and circumstantially he ended up in a place where the rent is very cheap, and that happened to be in the same area where the hippies were, because they also didn't have hardly any money, and they took an interest in it. Whereas there were not all the hippies, but in general, the hippies, they found it they found what Srila Prabhupada had to say, his message and his very personality attractive, interesting. They were willing to experiment with all kinds of different things, and especially if they were Eastern, what appeared to them to be mystical, and especially if it wasn't mainstream, orthodox, and accepted by the average straight American. So by circumstances orchestrated by Krishna, no doubt, Srila Prabhupada came into proximity with the hippies, who showed an interest in what he had to present, far more than others did. So Srila Prabhupada, he was preaching among the hippies, and they were interested in him, but at the same time, he did not at all stand for many of the things they stood for, or that was part of the hippie way of life. Although Srila Prabhupada was in some ways like them, by his very personality, symbolically against the whole American way of life. By symbolically, I mean the hippies, just by their dress, announced that we're not part of the straight society, and Srila Prabhupada did so also. But the idea of that the hippies had, that no discipline, no authority, freedom to do whatever you like, Srila Prabhupada wasn't for that at all. He was a disciple, and he was actually interested in making disciples. So disciple means discipline. And the hippies' use of drugs and free sex, Srila Prabhupada was against that. Srila Prabhupada wasn't a pacifist. Vegetarian, but not pacifist. Sometimes people are surprised at that. One devotee told me that he interviewed for a job, which he got working for the American military as a software programmer for intercontinental missiles. So when he went for the interview, he had to tell about himself. So he said, yeah, I'm a member of the Hare Krishna movement. And actually in America, quite a few initiated devotees are in the armed forces. So the interviewer asked him, Hare Krishna, you're vegetarian, aren't you? So how are you going to join the military? And he said, we're vegetarian, but we're not pacifists. It might seem to be a dichotomy, but actually it's not. That means we don't unnecessarily harm living beings, but we're not so impractical as to say that military forces are required to curb bad forces within the world. So Srila Prabhupada, as Hayagriva recounted, Srila Prabhupada was talking to an audience of university students, and then one asked about involvement in the Vietnam War. Presumably, he presumed that Srila Prabhupada would say, no, the Vietnam War is very bad, you shouldn't fight, and all this kind of thing. But Srila Prabhupada said, no, you have a democratic government, you elected your government, if the government tells you to go and fight, you have to fight. And you don't, if you kill on the order of a superior, you're not implicated in sin. And the audience didn't like that at all. And there was, the students, they didn't like that. They didn't want to get sent off to Vietnam. Come on, all you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam. Way over yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books and pick up a gun.
We're going to have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. There ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. That was the Country Joe, yeah. His only song that anyone ever knew of him. But it was a popular song in Europe, people didn't care that much, but in America they did, because any time the draft could come, and then you get sent off to Vietnam, and there's a good chance that you come back in a bag. You know what that means? You're wrapped up in a bag, sewn up, and that's it. They fly your body all the way back so that your parents can have the honor of burying you. Yeah. So they didn't like it, and the girls didn't like it either. In those days, they hadn't even thought of the feminist movement had started, but they hadn't got that. They hadn't progressed that far to think that women should be out in the jungles of Vietnam fighting. But they didn't want the boys to go, because if the boys go, then who are they going to have sex with? Make love, not war. That was the motto. But Srila Prabhupada said, no, you should fight. And they didn't like it. And although he didn't enforce it on the hippies, but if anyone had become his disciple, no drugs, no frivolous entertainment, no sex unless it's for procreation within marriage. He was for monarchy, which is totally against the democratic principle, authoritarian monarchy, actual monarchy. And even people were taught, oh, Gandhi, so wonderful, and President, what's so great about him? He wasn't a great fan of Gandhi's. He even said, which stirred up a lot of opposition, which neither the most straight Americans nor the hippies liked it, that women were naturally less intelligent than men. So it wasn't that he just fitted into the 60s American counterculture, which others like that Maharshi, Mahesh Yogi, they're able to fit in very nicely with that, because they didn't really have anything to say. They didn't really have any message to them. And they just take this transcendental meditation and you become more relaxed and more peaceful flower, holding a, his most important thing he had to do was to hold a flower and smile through his long beard. And there was nothing really to get upset about. Whereas with Srila Prabhupada, he had many things to say, which, if you consider, actually placed him in a position where actually the counterculture was actually closer to the mainstream culture than it was to Prabhupada. Prabhupada was not in line with either of them. He had his own completely distinct message. So what were the hippies attracted to? Well, Srila Prabhupada, again, he was very different. Srila Prabhupada protested against the hedonistic American culture, but then he also saw hippieism as another expression of heathenism. And also the music, that Srila Prabhupada is into music, that was much appreciated by the hippies. But it would, however we may analyze this in a sociological, whatever, anthropological way, really it was Srila Prabhupada's genuine spiritual message that made the impact, which mundane scholars, they can't understand that Srila Prabhupada, he spoke to the soul. It wasn't because of hippies or non-hippies or any such thing, but because Srila Prabhupada spoke to the soul. The hippies were more open to it, but because he gave them genuine spiritual experience, that's what actually impacted them. Otherwise, Srila Prabhupada, although he said that the hippies are our best customers, he also warned that we shouldn't present ourselves as hippies and that people shouldn't think of us as hippies. He certainly didn't want to see himself identified or his followers identified with the hippies. Another thing about that's important to say, that although the hippies were into mysticism and this and that, it was all this impersonalistic stuff. And Srila Prabhupada really had to hammer his early followers to get it out of them, or at least to some extent get it out of them. That's also described by Hayagriva, how Srila Prabhupada is on and on talking about impersonalists. And Mukunda Maharaj told me that in the early days, they wondered why Prabhupada was always talking about this. They thought that they didn't know who these Mayavadis were. They couldn't work it out. And they thought that, well, there's some sect back in India that Prabhupada has some hang-up about, and even though he's come here, he can't get it out of him, and he just keeps on talking about this. But, and Srila Prabhupada, because at that time Bhagavad Gita as it is had not been published, so Srila Prabhupada would lecture from an edition of Bhagavad Gita, which was available there at the time, and it seems it was read by many hippies, the edition with the commentary of Dr. Radha Krishnan, who was a Mayavadi. And Srila Prabhupada, he said that the verse translations are okay. He said anyone can translate the verses, but it's the explanations that are wrong. So Srila Prabhupada would use the verse translations, and then he would speak on Gita giving his own commentaries. Then when he came to chapter 9, text 34, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakto Majaji Mang Namaskuru Mame Vaishasi Yukvai Vamatmanang Matparayana, where Krishna says, always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, bow down to me. In this way, being linked with me, you will certainly come with me. And in the purport of that, Dr. Radha Krishnan writes that it is not to the person Krishna that we have to surrender, but to the unborn eternal within him. And Srila Prabhupada didn't like that at all. He criticized it thoroughly. But then Kirtananda, at that time, they were all in it. No one was initiated at that time. He said, well, what's wrong with it? And then he went on a long spiel about how all the teachers, both in the East and the West, they talk about this, and it's all one, and this and that, and Prabhupada was just sitting and listening, and you could see he was getting angry. And then after Keith, at that time, had gone on for some time, then he paused, and Prabhupada said, have you finished? And he hadn't finished, and he went on again, as quoting this, Chinese and Indians and John of the Cross and who knows what. He was well steeped in impersonalism. Then again, after some days, have you finished? And then he'd finished, and Prabhupada spoke, and he was angry. He was very, very angry. He said, this is Krishna is speaking. You think of me. Krishna establishes himself in the Bhagavad Gita as the personality of God. Then he roared, then why do you want to take it away from Krishna? Why do you deny Krishna? And Srila Prabhupada was so angry. And if you think about it, he could have lost them right there. It was quite possible that his few followers would have just not come back at all. They thought, well, he can say what he likes. We're not going to get shouted at like this. And the only people who had been coming to him regularly for a few months, he would have just lost them. But he didn't tolerate impersonalism. He took the risk of losing them to hammer out that impersonalism. He'd been speaking about impersonalism day in, day out. But they didn't understand. They thought it was someone else. They didn't understand that they were the impersonalists that he was talking about. It wasn't just some people in India. So Srila Prabhupada, he took that risk, but he wasn't going to let them go on and on coming and hearing him and remaining in their diseased, impersonalistic consciousness. So Srila Prabhupada, he was a committed personalist. He would not brook impersonalism. So in that way also, he was different to the hippies. They were interested in Eastern mysticism. Srila Prabhupada wasn't interested in Eastern mysticism. He was interested in Krishna. He was interested in the actual truth. He wasn't interested in all this vague, feely, lovey-dovey, all this stuff. This the hippie movement is, and its mystical speculations is a major factor in the present New Age movement, which is just another bunch of impersonal hocus pocus. Srila Prabhupada, his attraction, what attracted people to him, was definitely not based on telling them what they wanted to hear. He wasn't concerned with getting followers by telling them what they wanted to hear. He told them what they needed to hear, which in most cases, for most people, was not at all what they wanted to hear. But he came as a messenger of the absolute truth, not as a pseudo-spiritual businessman come to attract some followers and get a name and fame for himself. He just wanted to present Krishna and Krishna consciousness. He wasn't like the mystic kind of guru who would speak in a vague kind of way that gives you the impression that he knows something very deep which you don't know and you can't understand. Looking into the distance, looking up in the air as if he's or floating into mystic states. No such thing. No such thing. But Srila Prabhupada came to give the actual message of the absolute truth. He did so carefully also. It wasn't that Srila Prabhupada just said, all right, now you will surrender to Krishna. He introduced it bit by bit, that the guru should be served. He gradually introduced that. In the first days, he would do everything himself. He would cook, serve everyone, prasadam, and then after they'd all gone, he would clean up. They didn't even have enough sense that here's this, even if you take Prabhupada as an elderly gentleman, they didn't have enough sense to think that, well, we should help and clean up afterward. They just came and they, actually this hippie movement with all its pretensions to spiritualism, it was just based on mass selfishness, that's all. But Srila Prabhupada taught them about Krishna consciousness, and then gradually some started to think, well, maybe we should help, and gradually engage them in service. But it wasn't until quite some time later that Srila Prabhupada actually gave the culture and started to tell people the culture that the guru should be served, his order should be taken as the life and soul. And frankly, that's among our Western devotees, that culture still a lot got to be, I mean, not just the thing about the guru being served, but in so many ways, the culture is still very much lacking. And what is ordinary for devotees in India, what they can understand very easily, I mean, you don't even have to tell them. For Western devotees, this is my personal experience, they don't know, and even you feel afraid to tell them because they're so steeped in the Western way of life and thinking. And so it's definitely that the even now the general cultural India is much more conducive to Krishna consciousness than it is in the West, although India is very confused and mixed up, and the West also, but still the culture is much better in India. But Srila Prabhupada, he wanted to introduce that, and he did start to do so. Srila Prabhupada gradually introduced and that guru should be served, and some disciples, they naturally like to do that, and they experienced, some devotees expressed, they experienced a great joy in doing so, which they couldn't have imagined. Things like Satsarup, he would bring a mango every day for Srila Prabhupada. In those days, getting mangoes in America wasn't a very ordinary thing. So he found some store and he would bring one, the store that was selling mangoes, and he'd bring one for Srila Prabhupada every day. And he felt great pleasure in doing so, more pleasure than you can imagine. What pleasure would be there? You wouldn't think there'd be a great pleasure in that, but they devotees who did such very personal services, because it was reciprocation with a pure devotee of Krishna, they did feel great pleasure in doing so. Because if yasya prasadat bhagavat prasadaha, if guru is pleased, then Krishna is pleased. And that is experienced by the devotee. Purijan Prabhu, he describes in 1968 in the Second Avenue Temple in New York, he was just there for a weekend, and the devotees would send him out on various errands. Here, go do this, do that. One of the things was he had to buy a special brand of milk for Srila Prabhupada. And he wrote that the errand to purchase milk for Swamiji especially filled me with happiness. I chanted as I walked through St. Mark's Place and felt a deep, previously unexperienced joy. So that's noteworthy, is it not? How through sense indulgence of various kinds, being indulged in throughout life, this now he's become a devotee and he experiences a kind of happiness which surpasses any that he had experienced in all his endeavors to enjoy the world. He experienced a greater happiness by going to buy some milk. What's going on here? How is that possible? You can imagine, sometimes these TV people, they come up to you in the middle of the street unexpectedly and ask you some question. Did that ever happen to any of you? They just ask people something. Happened to me once in Puri, day after Ratha Yatra. So, and they ask you some question, and then on the spot you have to answer. So then if you go up to imagine some, all of a sudden some TV journalists come up and they say, well, what was the thing that gave you the most pleasure in your life? And you say, well, once I went to buy some milk. and I experience such great joy. Difficult to understand. But the point is, because he was doing it for Swamiji, as Prabhupada was called at that time, a menial service. Here we have a man, a highly intellectual, I'm not sure if he had a university degree, but certainly of that caliber, who found great joy in performing a menial service for Srila Prabhupada's pleasure. So that's the spiritual experience. One can have a spiritual experience by going to buy milk. If one thinks that I'm doing this for Srila Prabhupada, I'm doing this for Krishna. Now, another important thing to understand here is that that menial service is not something that anyone in America would aspire for. No one thinks, no child is trained to think, well, you can, when you grow up, you should be a toilet cleaner. Or you should be a driver on the, a bus driver. If there's ambition, it's usually to be something more than that. So the whole idea of being a servant, it goes against the ambition of the conditioned soul. I remember once seeing in Surat, a major city of India, a poster, an advertisement, in which it said, Nokari charo vyapar karo. Give up working as a... Well, Nokari literally means service, as a servant. So give up, what it means is give up a paid job and do your own business. And it was an advertisement to take a bank loan. So the idea, do your own business. And you'll find in India, it's changing now, but it used to be someone who had their own business. It might be their wife cooks samosas, and they in the morning and in the afternoon, they go around all the buildings calling out, samosa, 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 and the housewives buy a few samosas, and that's their business, and they maintain their family like that. So some very small-scale business with no not registered company or any such thing. But such a person would feel, I'm doing my own business, and they would feel, if someone asked, are you working? They said, no, I don't work for anyone. Someone might be earning 10 times more, but they would feel themselves in a better position because they're not doing shudra work by being paid, but they have their own independent business. So this idea, this pride of, I'm independent, but to become a servant, what is that? But to become a servant of Krishna and his devotees, that actually gives pleasure to the soul. And we'll see, I'll just give one instance in my own experience. Once I was in Nathdwara, which is the, we can say one of the two main centers of the Vallabh Sampradaya, And after Mangalarti, it's a bit late there because the idea is that Krishna's a little boy and don't get him up too early, let him sleep. So he has a good night's sleep because he has to go out all day with the cows. So after Mangalarti, I saw him. Immediately the temple hall, well, it's not exactly a hall, it's more like an auditorium, all the area around it was being swept by people who clearly were not paid sweepers. They were moneyed business people, probably from Bombay or Gujarat, who were doing that because it was service to the Lord. So that's there in Indian culture, that even though one may be a very big man of the world, when it comes to service to God and to sadhus, one should be prepared to do menial service So there's an example of Satsarup and Purijan Prabhu experiencing the happiness of serving Srila Prabhupada. The happiness that they felt was inexplicable, unexplainable, probably the mundane psychologists could work out something stupid to say about it, but it is actually coming from the spiritual platform, and it was this spiritual experience that Srila Prabhupada imparted in various ways. Here's a quote from Life with the Perfect Master. It's a book by Satsarup Das Goswami about a period between January and July of 1974 in which he was Srila Prabhupada's personal servant and secretary. And although he was a big man in the movement, during those weeks he would perform menial services such as bringing Srila Prabhupada his medicine, his toothbrush. His toothbrush consisted of a neem twig, accompanying him on his morning walk, preparing his breakfast and lunch and serving it, giving his daily massage. He was a menial servant. That was what he had to do. If he went back to his preaching field, he would be the big leader, but in that time he was in position of a menial servant. He describes the first time that he gave Srila Prabhupada a massage. He wrote that massaging Prabhupada was like a new initiation. From my side, it was a completely spiritual, ecstatic exchange, the essence of the personal servant's worship of the spiritual master. So it's a menial service, but he was very excited to do that because he understood that Srila Prabhupada is a completely spiritual person, and the opportunity to serve him in this way is a, in his own words, completely spiritual, ecstatic exchange. Similarly, touching Srila Prabhupada's feet, many devotees have stated that that simple act, I mean, physically it's a simple act. It's not like doing some complex yoga posture, and it doesn't require any great endeavor physically to do so. Many devotees have expressed that what joy they found in that. Recently in America, one devotee spoke to me with his eyes shining in happiness, telling me that he told me that for about 10 minutes he was talking about the time he touched Srila Prabhupada's feet, which would have taken less than 10 seconds, considerably less than 10 seconds, but such ecstasy he felt in that. So from all this we can understand that Srila Prabhupada is a very special person, that's an understatement, and he touched his devotees' lives in various ways, which is the topic of this ongoing series of talks. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna.